was first introduced by Thruway, he referred to it as the ego defense mechanisms. Techniques and methods employed by the ego to defend and protect us and itself from those things that would destabilize or undermine the effective functioning of the ego, which is supposed to be the executive of the personality, as we established previously. After those who were originally in affiliation with Freud, subsequently some of them broke with Freud and went on to formulate and develop their own theories. Different of those theorists, those psychologists, what have you, broke with Freud over certain aspects of his theory, and some of them rejected Freud's idea of the notion of the intrapsychic system, that there is this personality system within us, the id, the ego, and the superego. They said that's an arbitrary hypothetical construct that Freud put together as a way of trying to explain how personality works. And they denied the existence of those three structures or parts of the personality, and therefore those people weren't about to call them ego defense mechanisms since there was no ego to defend. So they simply referred to them as defense mechanisms. Still later, other and more contemporary points of view in psychology have said to refer to them as defense mechanisms tends to put kind of a negative spin on the whole concept, and that some of these things aren't defensive or self-protective, but in fact are positive, healthy, and adaptive functions. So rather than call them defense mechanisms or ego defense mechanisms, let's see if we can put the emphasis on the positive, and let's refer to them as the mechanisms of adjustment. So some of the most contemporary theories in psychology today refer to them as mechanisms of adjustment. Regardless of what you call them, what you need to know is that this idea was original to Freud's theory, and it is a part of his theory that has been picked up and utilized by virtually every theory in psychology since Freud's day. So it was originally part and parcel of his theory, but has been borrowed or purloined or absorbed by even the most contemporary theories. They may call it by a different name, but it's essentially the same thing. So this is one of the most widespread and generally accepted concepts in Freud's theory. We gave you some introductory comments on the ego defense mechanisms last time, so rather than belabor the point, let's cut to the chase. I have arranged these defense mechanisms in that list that I gave you in a particular way. And with the exception of the first one, the one that's listed number one under the ego defense mechanisms, and that's listed number one for two reasons. Number one, it was the first defense mechanism that Freud discovered. And number two, he says that is always the first line of defense or self-protection that we use. And only after we have attempted to use that defense mechanism do we then begin to use other defense mechanisms, either individually or in combinations with each other, to deal with what that one can't handle. Whatever residual stress or anxiety or conflict or threat is left over, we then deal with other defense mechanisms, but for those sources of stress or threat or anxiety or conflict that emanate from within us, says Freud, the first line of defense is always repression. An attempt on the part of the individual unconsciously to prevent unconscious urges, feelings, needs, impulses, or desires from coming to the surface, from entering into conscious awareness. Freud believed that some of those urges, impulses, and desires that we have are so primitive, animalistic, and potentially threatening, that were they to enter conscious awareness, they would have a very destabilizing effect on our personality and our mental activity. So repression, an attempt on the part of the individual to put a lid on the unconscious and to prevent what's in the unconscious from entering into conscious awareness. And this mechanism, like all the others, is employed unconsciously, but at the preconscious level of awareness, according to Freud. We are not aware of them when we're using them. And the minute material starts to emerge from that unconscious and hit to that preconscious level, that's why he calls the preconscious the gatekeeper. It is there to prevent the free flow of material from the unconscious into conscious awareness. And if you remember way back in the beginning of our discussion, we said that Freud believed that when the unconscious enters into conscious awareness and displaces what's supposed to be there, that's a condition we call mental illness. So the objective here is to keep our most primitive impulses and desires and needs below that conscious level, not in conscious awareness. After we've used repression, Freud says, we begin to employ others. Now, if you look at 2 through 12, they're arranged in a particular order. They're arranged in the order from the simplest and most basic defense mechanisms to the most complex and sophisticated ones. So the farther we go through this list, the more complex and sophisticated these defense mechanisms are. The ones near the beginning of the list, 2, 3, 4, etc., are the ones that we typically develop earliest on in life, and they are the most childlike, they are the most basic, the most straightforward. As we go along, they become more complex and sophisticated. And that's when we begin to use them in combinations with each other. Number 2 on the list that you see there is introjection. Introjection. You need to exercise a little bit of caution here. We used this term introjection before. When we used this before, we used it as a process, a normal developmental process that is employed in infancy, one in which the developing infant tends to take on or internalize the attitudes and the perceptions and the feelings of the adult caregiver. Remember, we said that person becomes the interpreter of reality to the child, and so the child tends to take on that person's outlook, their point of view, their perspective, their view of things, how they feel about things. Well, when it happens there, that's a normal developmental process. That's introjection. When it's used later on, after we're out of that stage of development, introjection can then be used as a employed as a defense mechanism. And very simply stated, this is a mechanism and a process by which somebody attempts to take on traits, qualities, attributes, attitudes, and feelings that are really a part of somebody else. In other words, to attempt to take on bits and pieces or components of someone else's personality and incorporate it into your own. To introject things from another, to take on qualities or characteristics of another person. They may be things that you admire, things that you like. But it's a process by which we attempt to become like someone else. Freud says this is a potentially problematic defense mechanism. And the reason why is because it tends to obscure the boundary between us and them. As we start trying to clone ourselves after that person and become more like that person, our own individuality, our own personality, can get lost in the shuffle, our own personal identity. So it is potentially problematic in that it weakens or undermines our own sense of self, our own sense of our own individual identity. Question? No. Multiple personality disorder is when someone assumes an entirely different identity that represents the opposite of what the original personality is as a way to compensate for deficiency. There's more to it than that. Often that multiple personality is the result of abusive, repetitive abusive treatment in childhood, infancy, and childhood, in which a new personality is formed to defend and protect the one that can't protect itself. Okay. The next one, number 3, it's the exact opposite of introjection. It's called projection. Projection, a defense mechanism by which a person has feelings or needs or desires or impulses inside of them that are so threatening or unacceptable to them and unacceptable to their society and their culture that what they attempt to do is to attribute those qualities or characteristics or needs or desires onto someone else. It's an attempt to externalize or project onto someone else things that are really a part of you, but which are unacceptable to you about yourself. Freud tells us this. When a person uses this defense mechanism, projection, that is to ascribe or attribute something that's really part of them onto somebody else, once they do that, they act as if what they projected were true, as if it were real, even though it's simply them attributing that to that person. They believe it, in other words. They accept that it's fact. The next one, number four, is one that we often use in conjunction with projection, in combination. The defense mechanism, denial. Denial, says Freud, is an attempt on the part of the individual to disown or disavow some aspect of themselves, to refuse to admit or accept something about them. So what typically happens is that first the person denies it as a part of them, and then they project it onto somebody else. Not me, I'm not like that, it's them. There's an addendum to this. Freud says, when a person develops a pattern of using these two defense mechanisms together, denial and projection, Freud says that's what constitutes paranoid thinking. A suspiciousness and a distrust of others or their motives or their feelings or intentions toward you. Jealousy, possessiveness, insecurity, fears of rejection or abandonment, all of these are tied in with denial and projection. It's a refusal to accept something about yourself, but a willingness to see it in everybody else or someone in particular. Careful, even paranoids have real enemies. Okay, number five. Listen very carefully. This is the first of the two doubles. A single defense mechanism that expresses itself in two very different ways, and therefore what Freud did was to separate them. The mechanism is called compensation. The first form of that is called direct compensation. This is a defense mechanism, a process by which a person who feels deficient, inadequate, lacking in something, something that obviously is important to them. And very often what they do in direct compensation is to find another area, and through the investment of a great deal of effort and energy, manage to excel in another area in order to call attention away from what they feel is their deficiency, their inadequacy. So it's to call their attention and everyone else's attention away from what they're lacking or what they're deficient in. Direct compensation. So the guy who really, for a variety of reasons, has a need to be recognized in school, to be called on, to participate, to get the approval, the praise, and the recognition of the teacher, to get the recognition of his classmates. But because of his academic ability, he's unable to do that. He's at best a mediocre student. But through the latter part of his elementary school years, his grammar school years, and in junior high, he discovers through a variety of circumstances that he has some exceptional athletic ability. And so rather than persist in trying to be a success and to achieve in the academic arena, he invests a tremendous amount of effort and energy developing his skill as an athlete, so that by the time he gets to high school, he is a truly exceptional athlete. And every time he achieves success on the field of athletic competition, it calls his attention and everyone else's attention away from the fact that he is at best a CD student and mediocre academically, but he certainly gets the recognition, the praise, and the approval of others that he so desperately needed. That's direct compensation, excelling in another area to call his attention and others' attention away from his felt deficiency, his perceived deficiency. By the way, it doesn't have to be a real deficiency. They simply have to feel that way about themselves. Okay? It can be as a result of a faulty self-perception or a poor self-concept, but that's the way they feel about themselves. So they invest a lot of effort and energy in another area. Second form of this is called overcompensation. This one's a little trickier. Overcompensation is a mechanism and a process by which a person feels deficient or lacking or inadequate or is inadequate or deficient in some area, but through the investment of almost superhuman effort and energy, manages to excel in the very same area where they were originally deficient. Overcompensation. Years ago in Tennessee, a little girl was born into a very large family in a very poor community in Tennessee. That child, because they came from such economic impoverishment, was between 4 and 5 years of age the first time the family was able to take her to an orthopedist, because she had been born with a partially deformed right leg. When they took her to the orthopedist, one of the things that happened was she was fitted with an aluminum leg brace and a pair of aluminum crutches. And the parents were told that their responsibility, their job, was to help her accept her limitations, her disability, and also to make sure that they kept a watchful eye. And as she grew, they needed to bring her in periodically to have her sized for a new leg brace. The parents accepted that as a fact, as a reality. The little girl didn't. She came from a large family. She wanted to be able to play with the other kids, but she couldn't. So every day when she came home from school, because her parents were busy, she would wander off by herself to the back of the property that they lived on, and she would take those aluminum crutches. She would lean them against a tree, and she would force her to walk with just the leg brace on until she could do that without limping. The next step for her, and this was all her own doing, was to wander off by herself, lean the crutches against the tree, sit down, take off the leg brace, and force herself to walk on that leg without a limp. And it caused a great deal of pain and discomfort. But when she finally mastered that, because she wanted to run and play like the other kids, she would force herself to try to run, and she would stumble and fall. And she was constantly getting scraped and bruised and beat up. True story. In 1960, that little girl had grown up. She was now 18 years of age. And in the 1960 Olympics, that girl named Wilma Rudolph won 3 gold medals in the 1960 Olympics in running events, and she was the fastest woman in the world in field and track. That is overcompensation. To excel in the very same area where one was originally deficient, and to be the best at it. That is overcompensation. Next defense mechanism. identification. Careful with this one. I've used that word before in here as a part of sexual identification, but this is not sexual identification we're talking about. This is a defense mechanism called identification. When a person feels lacking or deficient, or less than capable in some area, an area that's important to them, often what they do is to find somebody else, to form a friendship and a relationship with another person. That other person possesses what they feel they are lacking. So they try to find somebody who's smarter or more attractive or more talented or more athletic or more courageous or more heroic, and they develop a bond with that person, a relationship with that person. And every time that other person achieves success in the area where this individual is lacking, that person derives indirect satisfaction of their needs through the accomplishments and achievements of the other person. So the guy who's small and kind of slight and wouldn't think of starting a fight or being belligerent in school manages to befriend the class bully, and every time that kid takes somebody out back after school and punches their lights out, he says, "Hey, that's my friend." The father who was, in his youth, at best a mediocre athlete, pushes his son relentlessly until the son becomes an exceptional athlete, and every time that kid scores another touchdown, the father in the stand says, "Hey, that's my kid, chip off the old block, he's just like his old man." Deriving indirect vicarious satisfaction of your needs through the success, the achievement, and the accomplishments of another. That is identification. It's not just sports. My son, the doctor. My daughter, the lawyer. It isn't always between friends. It can be between parents and children. But in the real world, it's a person that we know, with whom we have an ongoing relationship, and there's some kind of a bond or connection. But please note that according to psychoanalytic theory, it is also this mechanism that is responsible for the phenomenal success of most spectator sports. People identify with a hero figure who's an athlete and derive satisfaction of their need for success and accomplishment through that person's accomplishments in the field of athletic competition. If you want to see real violence and aggression in a prize fight, don't look in the ring. Look at the people who are sitting in the first five rows or inside. If you want to see real violence and aggression at a hockey game, don't watch the ice. Look at the loony sitting just behind the glass. I coached soccer for almost 25 years. I can tell you for a fact, I know why they put up fences and dig moats around soccer fields. Keep the fans away from the sidelines. Ah, yes, identification. It is this mechanism that makes a phenomenal success out of people who are lead singers in rock bands or who are stars in television series. Yeah. But Freud says when it's used as a defense mechanism, it is an actual relationship with a real person with whom we have an ongoing connection. The next one, number 7 on your list, is rationalization. Probably one of the most popular and common defense mechanisms. Hell, everybody rationalizes. Rationalization is a mechanism by which we conceal our real motives from ourselves by substituting other, more acceptable motives in their place. Here's the shortcut. Here's the interpretive statement. Rationalization is the process by which many of us, if not most of us, give ourselves good reasons rather than the real reasons for some of the things we do, some of the things we think, and some of the things we feel toward other people. We rationalize. It's a justification of our thoughts, feelings, or behaviors. Rationalization. Giving good reasons rather than real reasons for many of the things that we do. The next one is another double. Now they're getting a little more complex and sophisticated. This one is called displacement. There are two forms of displacement. The first one is more direct and easy to get a handle on, so we'll deal with that one first. It's called substitution. The second one is called sublimation. Let's take a look at substitution. That's when a person conceals their real goal or object from themselves by substituting another in its place. A little boy and his sister were part of a very dysfunctional family unit. The mother and father were having inordinate marital problems. They were planning to separate as a prelude to a divorce. There was constant quarreling and fighting and arguing and bickering in the house, and on several occasions, the police were called to come and settle a marital dispute just before it came to physical violence. These kids were getting lost in the shuffle, and the parents, both of them, were avoiding the home as much as they could in order to avoid their spouse. The kids picked up the tension that was going on in the house. There were two children, a little boy and a little girl. The little girl was older. She was very bright, highly verbal, very articulate. Her little brother, younger brother, was the strong, silent type. He was actually bigger than she was. He was a good-sized kid. He had always been told by his parents that little boys never beat up little girls. So whenever they got into an argument, because she had much better verbal skills, invariably she won. Every day they would come home, one of them would retrieve the key that unlocked the house. They were latchkey kids, let themselves in, change their clothes, do their homework as directed by their parents, and then when all their homework was done, they'd go outside and find their friend and play. One day they got into a horrible argument when they got home from school. And as usual, she won. She'd already done her homework and she changed her clothes, and just before she turned triumphantly on her heels to stop out the front door and go find some friends to play with, she gave him one last verbal barrage and then walked out and slammed the door behind her, and that was it. As soon as she closed that door, he went upstairs to her room, got her favorite doll, took it down in the cellar and dissected it piece by piece. That is displacement. It is a process by which we take feelings and emotions that are generated over here and redirect them, in fact, misdirect them toward substitute objects. Substitution. Guy's boss reads him the riot act, tells him off, tells him if he doesn't shape up, he's going to fire him at the end of the week. Guy can't tell his boss off, he'll get fired on the spot. Leaves work in a rage, goes home, gets out of the car, screams at his kid for leaving his bicycle in the parking space in front of the house, goes inside and starts an argument with his wife. Displacement. Misdirecting feelings and emotions in another direction toward a substitute object. Please be advised that according to Sigmund Freud, this particular defense mechanism, substitution, is the defense mechanism that's potentially problematic because it's the one that's involved in most forms of sexual deviation. People with powerful, either normal, healthy, or very powerful sex drives, misdirecting them toward substitute objects, such as little children. Substitution. Taking feelings and emotions and misdirecting them toward substitute objects. You get angry with somebody, so you break something that belongs to them. Okay, the second variation on this theme is called, on this pair, is called sublimation. Everybody's heard the word subliminal, as in subliminal advertising. Here's where I take issue with Freud. He once said that the fully healthy person is the fully sublimated person. I don't agree with him. But ours is not to wonder why. We're talking about Freud's theory here, not mine. Sublimation. He said that is a mechanism by which a person takes certain kinds of urges, needs, desires, or impulses that are within them, that are unacceptable to them, and unacceptable to their culture, unacceptable to their society. Usually, though not always, says Freud, they are either sexual or aggressive in nature, and manages to find a way of channeling them into socially acceptable, socially sanctioned, socially rewarded avenues of expression. Sublimation. Channeling primitive urges, impulses, and desires into a socially accepted, socially rewarded avenue of expression. It is with some trepidation that I should give you an example of this. A number of years ago, I was working in a mental health facility, and I was referred a client who had just been psychiatrically discharged from the military. He had just been released from the psychiatric unit of the Philadelphia Naval Hospital. It appears as though he'd been there for quite some time as a result of the fact that he got into an argument with his commanding officer and stabbed his commanding officer with a bayonet. They tend to frown on that in the Marine Corps. So they put him in the psychiatric hospital, and they lost the key for a while, and they finally released him but referred him for outpatient treatment. I sat down with this guy and talked to him for a while. He took a rather instantaneous dislike toward me. Apparently, I reminded him of the commanding officer, I guess. I don't know. I did some psychological testing on this guy, and let me tell you, this guy was a train wreck looking for a place to happen. His personality was an absolute disaster. The guy suffered from what's called an explosive personality, an almost complete inability to control anger and rage, which could occur with the slightest provocation. He would go to a bowling alley or a pool hall or a bar, or hell, he could go to the movies and end up in a brawl. Invariably, the police would be called. He'd end up coming to his senses in the slammer after taking on three or four police officers and have absolutely no memory of what he had done prior to being taken into custody, prior to being arrested. And he had absolutely no ability to control rage. And I said to myself, my God, this guy's a potential serial killer. What the hell am I going to do with him? So the first thing I did, self-preservation, I referred him to one of the doctors on our staff for some medication to help him mellow out just a little bit and calm him down. After doing a comprehensive psychological testing and looking at this guy's personality profile, it suddenly occurred to me. Sublimation. So I called up a friend of mine who worked for the New Jersey Division of Vocational Rehabilitation. I said, Fred, I have a candidate for you for occupational retraining. Right now he's got a job and it keeps him away from people for 8 hours a day. He works for one of these lawn care companies, and he takes care of mowing the grass and trimming the hedges for these companies along the highway. And that's a good thing because it keeps him away from people for 8 hours a day. I'm worried about the other 16 hours. I said, I've done a complete psychological testing on him, and you don't even have to do an evaluation. I can tell you, and he's given me signed consent to release the information. I can even tell you what occupation or profession he is best suited for. He said, well, hell, send him right over. And I did. True story. Today that guy is very happily employed as a butcher. He cuts up chickens, pork chops, sides of beef, slices up steaks. The man absolutely loves his work. You give him a knife, a cleaver, and he's in seventh heaven. And that's what he does. So the next time you're in Bathmark, don't piss off the guy behind the butcher counter. It could be Lance. He takes offense very easily. That is sublimation, channeling primitive urges or impulses that the person has difficulty controlling into socially acceptable avenues of expression. I have a friend who for many years played in the NFL. He and I went to college together. He made All-American in his junior and senior year, was drafted in the third round of the NFL draft the year we graduated from college, received a very handsome signing bonus, and a whopper of a salary, and played for the Los Angeles Rams for 9 years as a defensive lineman. He grew up in Camden, New Jersey, in a family with an alcoholic father who was physically abusive to his children and his spouse. The father died when this guy was only about 14 years old. The mother wasn't able to keep the house, so they had to move to another neighborhood, one that was even worse than the neighborhood they lived in. And he had to travel in groups of two or three. He wouldn't get where he was going alive, let alone in one piece. He grew up in a family environment and in a neighborhood environment that created with him an incredible potential for violence. When he was on the East Coast, because there was a game here, he and I would, as often as possible, manage to get together and would go out for pizza, which was the excuse for a pitcher or two or three or four. And when he was on his third or fourth pitcher, he'd be more than happy to tell you that one of the reasons why he absolutely loved playing in the NFL was because every Sunday afternoon he had an opportunity to go out and beat the living hell out of people, for which he was incredibly well paid. That is sublimation. Channeling primitive urges and impulses into violent contact, professional football, etc. Next one, intellectualization. One of the more sophisticated of the defense mechanisms, intellectualization. According to Freud, that is a defense mechanism unlike the others we have spoken about or will talk about, and it is not common to everyone. This particular defense mechanism tends to be most widely used among people who are above average in intelligence. The brighter a person is, the more they tend to use this particular mechanism. I guess that's one of the reasons why, in my experience, it's one of the most common defense mechanisms used by college students. Intellectualization. It is a defense mechanism and a process by which a person finds a way of separating their thoughts and ideas from their feelings and emotions, and manages to seal off their emotions and avoid them by dealing with things in a highly intellectualized, detached, cognitive manner as a way of avoiding their true feelings and emotions. Separate thoughts and ideas from feelings and emotions, seal off those feelings and emotions so we don't have to deal with them by dealing with life and with situations, particularly emotionally charged situations, in a very detached, cool, calculating, analytical way. It's almost as if this person, in situations that would bring most of us to our knees emotionally, appear to be experiencing no emotion at all. A blunting of emotional responsiveness in highly emotional charged situation, and just dealing with things in a very logical, analytical way. Not at all. I would call them the opposite of empathetic. Has no idea why everybody's running around like a chicken with their head cut off. Because they feel nothing. As soon as you start cranking up the heat, that's when this person shuts down emotionally. Intellectualize. To deal with things logically, analytically, cerebrally. A situation that I became familiar with not long ago, in which there was an unfortunate death of a parent in a family of four kids. It was a work-related accident, and the father died on the job, very unexpectedly. There's no way you could prepare somebody for this. Of all the people, the children in the family, the one son, the eldest son, was the one that had paired with the father. And they did a lot of things together. They went to sports activities together. They went to games together. They went fishing together. It was the parent that, without question, this one son was the closest to. And everybody who knew that family, including yours truly, assumed that that was the one kid in the family who was going to be most devastated by the loss of the father. And yet all of us were shocked at the level of maturity that this young man demonstrated in that very volatile situation. He was the one who accompanied his mother to the funeral parlor to make the necessary arrangements. He went with her to the cemetery to arrange for a burial plot. He was the one that asked his mother where the phone book was, and he wrote down the names of all of the relatives and friends, both in and out of state, and made sure he contacted everybody. Each day at the funeral parlor for the viewing, he stood right there, suit and tie on, next to his mother, great source of support for her, and everybody just marveled at the maturity that he was demonstrating. When the funeral was over, and everybody went back to work, back to school, and started picking up the pieces of their lives, that's when he fell apart emotionally. What he did was to occupy himself with lots and lots of things to do, lots of things to organize, lots of things to think about and deal with in a very cerebral way, as a way of avoiding his rage, his anger, his grief, his sorrow over the loss of his father. Why the one parent he was the closest to? So very often it's a stopgap, short-term kind of solution to a very explosive emotional situation that the person uses just to white-knuckle their way through it. And after the fact, These are people who often deal with their feelings after something has occurred, after the tragedy has happened. Intellectualization. Next one, perhaps the most sophisticated of the ones on your list. Reaction formation. One of the people who worked in very close association with Freud, one of the people you read about in that chapter on personality, was Carl Jung. Carl Jung was in very close connection with Freud at the time. He was Freud's hand-picked successor. Freud chose him to be the leader of the psychoanalytic movement after Freud was no longer around. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. It was at Freud's insistence that Carl Jung was elected the first president of the International Psychoanalytic Association. Not Freud, he didn't want it. He said he didn't want people to think of it as a cult that had just formed around a particular individual. He wanted somebody other than himself to be the president of the International Psychoanalytic Association. And the candidate that Freud nominated was Carl Jung. Jung was an incredibly bright guy, and these two men had a great deal of respect for each other. Eventually, after between 7.5 and 8 years, these two men split and Jung went off. Most people don't know that Carl Jung had been working on his own theory of personality before he ever met Freud. And he put it on the back burner and he threw in and worked closely with Freud because he was really enthused about Freud's ideas. But as time went along, their intellectual and personal differences caused a wedge, a rift between them. So when Carl Jung broke with Freud, he left, but he took this defense mechanism, reaction formation, and used it as the cornerstone and the foundation for his theory. He changed the name of it. He called it the principle of opposites. And his principle of opposites is very much like this reaction formation. Carl Jung said, for everything that exists in a person's psyche, there also exists its corresponding opposite. So all of us have within us the potential for good and bad, healthy and unhealthy, normal and abnormal. He said, from the presence and the coexistence of polarities, psychological energy is created. He said, I see in all things that happen the interplay of opposites. And from that, he derived his notions about psychic energy, or psychological energy. Reaction formation. The original version of reaction formation as a defense mechanism is this. When a person has feelings or urges or impulses or desires that are so unacceptable to them, and so unacceptable to their society on an unconscious level that on the conscious level they react in a way that is the exact opposite of what's really going on in their unconscious. A good way to remember this is that it's sort of like the person makes their conscious mind a reverse mirror of what's going on in their unconscious. Making one's conscious thoughts, ideas, and awareness a reverse mirror of the unconscious. 180 degrees the opposite of what's going on an unconscious level. The next two we've talked about, what we talked about in a different context, they bear restatement here. Next to the last, fixation. Those who are of a psychoanalytic orientation suggest that fixation is a mechanism and a process by which a person refuses to move forward, remains in a particular stage. There's a refusal to progress as a way of calling attention to yourself, your dilemma, your needs. They say that very often this one is used when a child is attempting to rebel against a very unhealthy family situation or something going on in their life that's very pathogenic, something that's potentially detrimental to them psychologically and emotionally. And it's almost like a disguised cry for help, calling attention to oneself by refusing to grow and mature and take on new function, but remaining in a less mature childlike state. Fixation as a defense mechanism. The last one we talked about last time, regression, or regression in service of the ego. it is that point at which progression or moving forward stops and backward motion begins. It's a process of reverting back to an earlier, less mature, more childish or childlike pattern of functioning as a way of trying to cope with threat or stress that is overwhelming to us. To deal with something in a more simplistic, childlike way that we're not able to handle in a way that's appropriate for somebody of our age. So it's an attempt to go back and to recapture an earlier point in time when your life was simpler, when help was around, when you could turn to your parents, when you had a support system of the family, when people were there to help you. And problems could be more easily solved and resolved. Regression. Now, that's the dozen, but if you include the doubles, it's tantamount to 14. If you count the two, compensation and displacement, as doubles, and you count each of those individually, it's 14, but overall, it's an even dozen defense mechanisms.